Hi, you're listening to Stefan Levera Podcast, a show about Bitcoin and Austrian economics brought to you by Swan.com. Lawrence Leppard of Equity Management Associates rejoins me on the show, and we're talking about the cost of living crisis, going into recession, generational conflict and boomer hate, as well as US government debt and how many things are breaking. Now, before we begin, remember, Pacific Bitcoin Festival is coming up. It's in LA, October 5th and 6th, and now is a great time to look up your flights, get your tickets, organize your hotels, and all of this stuff. There's an awesome lineup of speakers, people like Max Keiser and Stacey Herbert, Preston Pysh, Alex Gladstein, Lynn Alden, Jimmy Song, and so many more. There's going to be multiple stages. This is a great opportunity to learn about Bitcoin and to meet other Bitcoiners. And this is actually a great opportunity if you have family and friends, think about bringing them along. There's different ways to get them exposed to Bitcoin and see that this is not just some online internet nerd thing. This is a real technology. This is a real movement. And Pacific Bitcoin is going to help push that forward by spreading the message about Bitcoin. So go to pacificbitcoin.com. Use code Levera for a discount on your tickets. Mempool.space is a comprehensive Bitcoin and blockchain explorer. You can see the mempool, you can see the blockchain, you can see second layer networks like the Lightning Network, and you have a Lightning Network explorer there. So you can see what are some of the large nodes, where are they hosted, and all kinds of interesting statistics that you can use in terms of how you manage things in your Bitcoin journey. So when it comes to sending Bitcoin transactions, you can go there and search and target your fee based on low, medium, or high priority, which is listed on the site, and they have various integrations into other wallets, so you might even be using mempool.space integration without even knowing it. They also have a new feature coming soon, which is the Mempool Accelerator integration, so keep an eye out for this one. It's going to be a really interesting one, and of course, you can host this yourself. It's free and open source software, so go and check it out over at mempool.space. And now onto the show with Lawrence Leppard. Larry, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Stefan. Really great to be with you again.
Always lots of things going on. And, you know, I think probably the biggest one that just seems to be in the conversation now is this cost of living crisis. And I'm sure you're seeing some of these similar videos where there are young people and middle-aged people who are just literally making TikTok videos and otherwise videos just explaining they can't even afford the cost of living. So I'm curious if you have any initial reactions on that, and where does, you know, the fiat money play into this?
Well, I mean, you know where the fiat money plays in, but I'll go over it. But yeah, I very much have a reaction to that. I mean, it's terribly sad, and you see it kind of everywhere. And you know, we see the videos, you know, we see this Oliver gentleman who came out with this great song, and it really struck a chord with kind of middle America. And you know, I retweeted this morning on Twitter, you know, Civil War is one of the trending memes on Twitter. I mean, it you know, in online, it's incredibly sad. I mean, you know, the central banks have behaved irresponsibly. We all know that. They printed a ton of money, and as a result, we've had widespread inflation, and it hurts the most vulnerable. I mean, you know, those who are living closest to the edge, if suddenly their cost of everything goes up, the cost of getting to work, the cost of feeding themselves, I mean, the essential cost, their cost of electricity, it's extremely painful. And it's all driven by fiat money and the excesses of fiat money. And I think we're approaching kind of the end game of the fiat money regime. But sadly, that's going to take some time to play out. And there's going to be a lot more pain before it finishes playing itself out, I think.
Yeah, and of course, I agree with you. But I think there's two sides to this story as well, because it could also be that fiat currency has caused people to try to live beyond their means, right? It made them believe that, oh, I don't need to live with my family. I can live out on my own, right? And maybe there's an element to which people are living more atomized lives and not family-oriented lives. And I'm wondering whether you think that's also played into this also.
That's a great question. I think that's probably true. I mean, I think when the good times are rolling, you know, people are, they're gambling and they feel like they have extra money and they maybe take on too much leverage. They buy more house than they need. They do things they don't need to do. You know, certainly tough times cause you to focus in on, you know, what really matters, you know, and it's your own personal health and survival and your family. And that's, you know, those are the things that are important. And yeah, a lot of the frivolous stuff, I suspect, is going to have to fall by the wayside. And some of that's good. I mean, gambling on meme stocks and, you know, all the crypto nonsense. I mean, that stuff ought to go away because it doesn't add any value to the economy whatsoever. So, some of that is good. And yes, people did make unintelligent decisions because they were misled into thinking asset prices would always go up. you know, yeah, sure, I should buy that extra big house. I should lever it up, no problem. And, you know, maybe that's going to prove that it wasn't such a wise decision, right?
Yeah. And I mean, your point as well, that is still a fiat consequence, right? It's that people were misled by the manipulated interest rates and the manipulated markets for credit that we all live in.
Yeah. And I mean, I see that in some friends I know, people who've taken out HELOCs, you know, home equity line of credit. And of course, 2008 taught us, you know, this, that we could, you know, you could kind of treat your home like it's a bank account and you can borrow against the value. And I think they were offering HELOC rates as low as 100 basis points, 200 basis points. And when you can borrow money at 1% a year, well, okay, do it. And borrow it and speculate and borrow it and buy stuff, buy it and borrow it and live well, whatever. Well, as we all know, with the interest rates going up the way they have, those HELOC rates are now in those 6, 7, 8% range. And suddenly that really starts to bite. So yes, people were misled by the bad monetary policies. You know, ZIRP was just an amazing crime. Having the cost of money be zero for as long as they had it be zero was just, it was a terrible thing, really bad. It completely distorted the economy in every way. So.
Yeah, and it seems to really, genuinely, it seems to be a global thing, right? We're seeing some of these videos of TikToks and people like this who are talking about their problems in America or in Canada. I'm hearing about stories even back in Australia. Like, we're seeing news articles of families who can't afford the mortgage anymore. I'm born in Sri Lanka, and we were recently there for a family trip. I'm hearing about massive difficulty there in Sri Lanka. Like, so it's all over the world.
Yeah.
And people, unfortunately, are not able to point their finger at the right problem, aren't they?
In many cases. I mean, obviously, the Bitcoiners have figured it out, but sadly, a lot of other people haven't. That's why we say, fix the money, fix the world. I mean, it's very easy for these political tribes to get everybody, you know, all the blue guys saying it's the red guys, and the red guys saying it's the blue guys. And it's really both of them. You know, it's neither one is clean. And I suspect the same is very similar in other countries. You know, the politicians want you arguing with each other rather than arguing at the core level, which is, if we had sound money, these problems would not exist in the form that they exist.
Yeah. And what we've seen as well is, related to that earlier idea that artificially low interest rates cause some of these beliefs. A related idea is this gentleman, I believe his name is Robert Henderson, and I think he coined this term or popularized this term of luxury beliefs, right? This idea that, you know, very rich people and maybe people who've been misled to believe they are rich can believe certain ideas. Like a common example might be net zero, this idea that we can just have net zero emissions and just live in this kind of fantasy utopia without energy, with 80% of energy being fossil fuel or hydrocarbon energy. And so I think to some extent, some of these so-called luxury beliefs are going to have to crumble, aren't they?
Yeah, they definitely are, particularly around, you point out a good one with that energy thing. I mean, the other one was with the whole COVID scare. I mean, we've got to save everybody's life from what's really just a bad case of the flu at enormous cost to the economy and a lot of other people. And so, with an untested vaccine that's now turned out to be quite dangerous. So, yeah, I mean, luxury beliefs, I mean, bad thinking, you know, fiat thinking is prevalent when the money is broken. You know, there's a lot of bad thinking in a lot of areas, and it's very unfortunate. I mean, we need to, you know, this is a crisis and it needs to resolve, and we need to get to the other side of it, because when we do, you know, there won't be any time for this stupid thinking. I mean, it's all just going to fall away.
Yeah. Now, Larry, you've been investing for a long time, and you've seen many cycles. You've seen prior cycles play out. So I'm curious if you see any parallels, right? Dot-com bubble, the 2007-2008 GFC. Do you see any parallels and any insights that you could share for younger investors and listeners?
Sure. I have seen a lot of cycles. As you point out, I am old, older. These things do just repeat themselves over and over and over again. And I mean, this is from the beginning of time, really, if you go back far enough. But, you have boom and bust cycles. You know, it was in the Bible, 7 years of, you know, good times and 7 years of bad times. And so, yeah, I mean, what we're in right now, I think right now a lot of people are confused, and they kind of think that we had this COVID crisis and that it created a lot of money and therefore created a lot of inflation. And there's a certain amount of belief I see, which, I mean, as an investor, what you kind of look for is the deviant view of, you know, what is it that the market doesn't see that correct or isn't looking at correctly. And in my opinion, what the market is not looking at correctly is the fact that we're not going back to the 40 years of deflation that we had from the 80s, early 80s into 2020, when, you know, in March of 2020, the 10-year bond hit, you know, 50 or 60 bips. I mean, that's not happening. The world has changed, maybe not forever, but for a time. We now live in an inflationary world for a variety of reasons, and you know, long list. But and I think that the markets have not fully accepted that, and still, you know, the 5x5 Treasury swap says, you know, they think we're going back to 2 or 3% inflation. People think Jerome Powell is going to be successful. He was recently hailed in some article, you know, I think it said the genius of Jerome Powell. I mean, to me, that was like a flashing red light indicator. Okay, this is about to blow up again. And so, you know, to me, the period we're in right now, the raising of rates post, you know, post the problems, it feels a lot like kind of March of 2008, where, you know, Bear Stearns failed. I mean, Silicon Valley Bank to me reminds me of Bear Stearns. And the big one hasn't hit yet, but it's going to hit. And so there's a lag effect. They started raising rates in February 2022. And there's always a lag effect. And, you know, it's starting to really bite now, I think, and it's going to continue to bite. And we saw it in these regional banks, these large regional banks. It's going to happen in some of the smaller regional banks, and it's going to happen in other places, commercial real estate, et cetera. And so, in my opinion, things are going to start to get pretty tough. And, of course, the Fed will hang on too long to these higher rates. They'll say they really want to calm inflation. And then eventually something's going to break. And when it breaks, they're going to change, they're going to pivot, and they have to pivot, because if they don't, they're going to have, you know, a credit collapse that's going to rival the 1929 period. And some people think that's what they want, and maybe they do, but I kind of doubt it. I think at the end of the day, they're political animals, and they respond to what the greatest cry for is, for, you know, to solve the pain. And of course, the greatest cry recently, and a year ago for sure, and even recently, has been stop this inflation. You know, this inflation is eating us alive, stop it. And so, you know, Powell has been extremely aggressive at trying to do so. You know, inflation is starting to come down. I'm not sure how far down it will come. I'm not sure if it'll continue. You know, they, part of the way they were able to stop it was releasing all the oil they released from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. So they manipulated one of the big components of inflation. And you can only do that once. So, you know, my opinion is that we're about to go the other direction here. And, you know, the things will start, you know, unemployment will rise, businesses will have a hard time, things will start to collapse, we'll have more Silicon Valley-like bank-like episodes, and they will stop raising, and then the stock market will probably fall, because historically that's the pattern, and the bond market, I think, will continue to fall. And that's the piece I think most people don't get, is that the bond market's going to wake up to the fact that they just can never stop printing. And so when that occurs, you know, you're going to see, in my opinion, much higher interest rates from here. And as we all know, there's just a piece of this math that doesn't work. I outlined it on Twitter yesterday with a thread that just shows, you know, I think tax receipts are down, I believe, 7%. Federal government spending is up 14%, you know, and the deficit is growing very rapidly. And interest rates, the chart on interest rates, which we've all seen, U.S. government federal interest rate interest payments, is really kind of going parabolic. And so they cannot continue to raise these rates. And in fact, they're going to have to cut them, or else there's going to be a financial explosion here that's going to make 2008 actually look relatively contained. I think that's very hard for most people to accept. But based on my reading of history and my experience doing this since the early 80s, that's kind of what I believe is going to happen. Now, the tough part is the timing. You know, my partner says, and he could be right, they could hold it together for another couple of years. I kind of doubt that. I think a couple of years is too long. I think they might be able to hold it together another 3 to 6 months, maybe a year. I don't know, but it's coming. You can see the problems are coming. They're building. So that's kind of how I view it.
One other area. Now, obviously, I know you're a fan of Austrian economics, as I am also, and a promoter of Austrian economics. Now, one area that we as Austrians would critique the mainstream is we would say, we would reject, let's say, Phillips curve thinking. This notion that just because you've raised the interest rates, that somehow that's going to tamp down inflation. And I think, I mean, traditionally, they, you know, the Keynesians and the neoclassicals, they sort of think of it like, oh, you can have a trade-off between having high inflation or high unemployment, and, you know, the central bank and the wise government should manage, you know, the money supply and the interest rates and so on to try to, you know, manage that. But I think then what happened is in the 70s, there was stagflation. It was high interest rates and high unemployment.
Right. Yeah.
And that sort of disproved that. But then it seems like, now I know you obviously know better, but it seems like the mainstream financial press are just falling back into that same Keynesian frame. Do you have any insight on why they're doing that? Is it just that they've forgotten? Is it that they just haven't read enough? Why is that?
I don't know. I mean, I think the, you know, the Fed and the Keynesians have really polluted the entire economics, you know, industry and commentary at. And, you know, if you don't believe their stuff, you get thrown out. You're not invited to any of the conferences. You're not allowed to ask questions at the press conferences, et cetera. So I think they just, you know, they conveniently ignore it because it doesn't help, you know, their narrative. I mean, that's my way of explaining. I think some of them are starting to realize it and they quote unquote know better. I mean, we're seeing this whole discussion of, you know, kind of fiscal dominance. I mean, even there was even a Fed paper on it. So, you know, they realize they've got a problem, but I think that what they are good at and what they intend to plan to do, and I'm sure they have a lot of things in their back pocket that they'll pull out as necessary, is kick the can, you know? And so, you know, the BTFP was a perfect example of kicking the can. Right. I mean, they had said they would absolutely never bail out the banks again. That's what Dodd-Frank said. They said the depositors would have to take haircuts. We're not making the mistake we made in 2008 again. Well, guess what? You know, Silicon Valley Bank got in trouble. First Republic followed. It looked like a large number of the regional banks were going to go down. The $17 trillion of U.S. bank deposits were going to be at risk. You know, yelling flip-flop back and forth a couple of times. Well, we're going to guarantee them. No, we're not. Yes, we are. No, we're not. And then they realize that if we don't do something to help these banks out, you know, we're gonna have a bank run on our hands. And so they created a program, you know, to basically swap, you know, good paper for bad paper or discounted paper. And so, you know, this is the kind of thing they do to keep their broken system going. And I think they have other things up their sleeve that they will kind of continue to do. But in my opinion, the market is larger than they are, and the market is going to overwhelm them. I mean, another good example is if you look at the 10-year U.S. or U.K. gilt yield. You recall last fall in September that blew out, and the pound was falling fast, and the gilt yield was going up very quickly, and U.K. government had to step in to solve it. And interestingly, you know, they did for a while. But now that gilt yield is back above the time at which that last crisis occurred. And so, you know, the rates are going to continually march higher. That's the fly in the ointment for their system. And, you know, if they lose the bond market and they have to start buying the bond market to keep rates low, it's all over. And the problem that they've got is that, you know, they are the biggest borrower. I mean, the U.S. government has, you know, $33 trillion roughly of debt. A large portion of which, I mean, you know, I would say over a third, maybe as much as 40%, rolls in the next couple of years. And it's short. And so at 5% or 6% or 7%, you know, the interest expense for the U.S. government is just going to, it's already approaching $1 trillion annual run rate. You know, I saw projections that showed it could go to $1.2 trillion, $1.4 trillion, $1.5 trillion. I mean, at some point, interest becomes the entire U.S. federal deficit or federal budget. And so this is a problem. This is a fundamental problem that mathematical, that they can't really solve unless they can get interest rates down. And the only way to get interest rates down is to inject more money into the system to make money more plentiful so that, you know, the supply of money increases and the rate of the money therefore falls. But in so doing, the injecting money into the system is QE. It's buying, you know, those bonds and it's printing, right? And so that is what they will, in my opinion, have to do. The only issue is when. Do they, and in what way do they do it? And the longer they delay, the larger the amount of the print is going to be. You know, at some point they're going to have to come back in. I mean, I think I've said on record in the past, I think the Fed balance sheet, which was almost as high as $9 trillion, now is in the eights. I think it's likely to go as high as $20 or $30 trillion on the next print. So it's quite a pickle they've got themselves in. But you know, right now they're in a period where they kind of look sort of smart. I mean, you know, Jerome Powell is being hailed as a genius for the way he's managed this. And so we'll see how people feel about that in a year, or certainly in 2 years. I think they're going to feel a lot differently about that.
Yeah. And as they temporarily look smart right now, I guess I'm thinking about potential ways that they will try to have their cake and eat it too, right? So I'll give you an example. They, in the, you know, if we rewind back to the 2008, you know, or maybe even a little bit after, there was this whole concept of interest on excess reserves, right? So this idea that they would sort of help the banks,
yes,
but pay them also so that they wouldn't loan it out.
Right.
So that in their view, it would try to let them help bail out the banks, but without causing an inflationary consequence. Correct. So do you think there's a chance that they can try something similar to that this time around?
Very much so. I mean, and there's some great papers out on that talk about how they've done that. I mean, they have a lot of tricks up their sleeve, and they control all the levers of the monetary apparatus. And so, you know, they created this reverse repo facility, which absorbed a lot of capital. You know, of course, it made the Fed, you know, net negative in terms of, you know, the Fed's income statement, right? They're paying out huge interest rates to people who park their money there to prevent it from going into the economy. But yeah, there's no question. They have a number of dials that they use to try to stabilize prices and stabilize the monetary system and keep liquidity out there. I wouldn't be at all surprised to see them invent some new programs. I mean, the BTFP, they invented that out of thin air, and I suspect they'll do similar things. You know, we're also seeing that they're doing everything they can to forgive as much debt as possible. I noticed last night I tweeted about it that Biden just announced he's got a new program for forgiving some more student debt on some kind of a technicality, even though the Supreme Court said that he was unable to, you know, forgive his student debt. I didn't dig into the technicality, but the point is they are going to do everything they can to keep the system running and functioning. And that's the piece that people miss about the Federal Reserve. I mean, they have a dual mandate of full employment and stable pricing. And of course they failed on the stable pricing, and they're somewhat close to failing on the full employment. I mean, as Saylor points out, the employment numbers are all cooked, right? I mean, if you've got 40% of the people not in the workforce, I mean, what does full employment mean? You've got all kinds of people who've gone on disability. What does full employment mean? But their third mandate that's not stated, but it's very obvious, is to prevent financial dislocation. And, you know, what they're doing right now is going to lead to financial dislocation. And, you know, March of 2020 was a perfect example of how when you have financial dislocation, they will come in all guns blazing to print money and keep the system going. March of this year, 2023, when Silicon Valley Bank was on the edge, was another example, a very good example of, you know, there's a serious problem in the system. What are we going to do? We're going to invent a new program to solve that problem and sweep it under the rug. But it was money printing, and so there will be more of those. But the fact that there will be more of those means that, you know, for us, that there will be more money printing, which is back to our initial premise, you know, as Bitcoiners, which is that fiat is programmed to debase. You know, it literally cannot exist without debasement, because you have to create the new money to pay the interest on the old money that you've got out there. And that old money is, you know, the amount of old money is growing in terms of debt, because money is loaned into existence. I mean, this is my pinned Twitter feed, which shows, you know, the GDP growth as against the growth in debt. I mean, there's a fundamental problem here that is going to get reconciled. And in my opinion, this is what this fourth turning is all about. You know, the money is breaking. I mean, I'm almost finished with Neil Howe's book, you know, on We Are in the Fourth Turning, and I'm shocked at how little he focuses on the monetary piece of it, because it's so clear to me that that's the issue. You know, I don't think this is going to be a great war fourth turning. It could be, but I don't think so. I think mankind has evolved to the point at which, you know, the largest powers recognize that to enter into a nuclear exchange would mean the end of all of us. So as a result, I don't think we're going to have a world war. The proxy wars probably continue, but I think that really what's going to happen is all these currencies are going to fail. You know, I tweeted the other day, I mean, we are all Argentina, you know, or Turkey. We're just at, you know, or Venezuela or Zimbabwe or whatever, you know, whatever capital you want to use. We're just at various stages on the curve. Now, that could take some time. So it's not like it's going to happen tomorrow. But to me, it's clearly happening. And I would say, I would submit at an accelerated pace. You know, if you recall in, you know, the 08 crisis, we created $3 trillion worth of money in over the course of 3 or 4 years. Here, we created $5 trillion worth of money in 18 months. You know, on the COVID crisis. And my suspicion is the next one will be large enough that it'll lead to a much bigger number. And at some point, people are going to wake up and realize, you know, these people really don't know what they're doing. And as a result of the fact that they don't know what they're doing, they're going to run us into the ditch. And therefore, I've got to own something that they can't print. And, you know, tangible assets, you know, and Bitcoin, a tangible ledger, an immutable ledger, really are the two natural choices. So
Back to the show in a moment. When it comes to securing your Bitcoin, CoinKite.com are unmatched in terms of providing ultra-secure hardware devices that you can use to secure your coins, most notably the Cold Card. But don't forget, they also have a range of other accessories that you can use. So for example, there's the Block Clock, which you might have seen in the background of different videos of various famous people, and it's really a great accessory to have. They also have the metal seed backup product, which is called the Seed Plate. So that's another really cool one that you don't want to forget. And they have other accessories that you can use with your Cold Card, such as the Cold Power and a range of other tools and accessories. So go to coinkite.com and use code Livera for a discount on your Cold Cards and get other Bitcoin gear there. Next up is Base58. Base58 is a Bitcoin protocol school. Are you looking to learn to build with Bitcoin, or do you want to learn about Bitcoin development? And don't be worried, they have classes ranging all the way from beginner up to expert. They have classes that are online as well as in-person intensive classes where you can learn in a safe and easy environment from Bitcoin and Lightning experts. So they've got a Taproot intensive in-person class coming up soon. This covers Taproot, obviously, TapScript, Schnorr, Frost, and Music too. This is an in-person class. It's coming up just prior to TabConf in Atlanta, so that's 4th to the 6th of September. And this same class is on again in Austin, the 13th to the 15th of November. Now, for this one, it is an expert-level class, but make sure you go online and apply for this over at base58.info. If you're looking to learn to build with Bitcoin and you want to become a Bitcoin developer, go to base58.info. And now, back to the show.
Yeah, and so we've been speaking a little bit about the possible responses. As you said, they could make up a program. There are talks of various different ideas out there. I recall if you went back, let's say 10 years ago, there was a lot of talk about bail-ins. That was seen as a tool for the banks to sort of stay solvent. Everyone should take they use the colloquial term haircut. This idea, you know, a nice way of saying we're taking your money. And this was a narrative in Cyprus in 2013 as well, that there was a bail-in in the banks, and that drove, whether or not that was why people were buying Bitcoin, there was a Bitcoin price pump around that time.
Yeah.
So there's kind of this idea of bail-ins. There's the idea of bail-outs. There's the concept of, you know, BTFP and these various financial programs. I think these are probably some of the likely policy, let's call them policy responses. Do you have any others that you can think of that they could do that are, you know, government policy responses?
Yeah, I think they're going to at some point get smart and recognize that gold and silver and Bitcoin are the exit ramps, and they don't want people using the exit ramps. I mean, this is what, you know, Elizabeth Warren's anti-crypto army has gone after. And I think, you know, having been screwed by them constantly throughout my career, watching them, you know, take moves that are adverse to my positions, like banning short selling of financials in September of 2008, I wouldn't surprise me at all if a narrative starts to develop that these sound money guys are ruining our good fiat system. And therefore, you know, gee, if you own Bitcoin or gold or silver, you need to report what you own. And we're doing it for tax reasons because we think you're all tax cheats. And, and furthermore, you need to, tell us how much of it you own and maybe give us the addresses. And then if they want to get really aggressive, they could start to say, and by the way, you know, they could see a monetary reset coming. I mean, I think right now they're not doing these things because they're not smart enough to do them, but I think they might get smarter as time goes by. And, you know, by the way, you guys are about to get windfall gains as a result of what's going to happen with this monetary reset. And therefore, you know, capital gains tax on Bitcoin and gold and silver is now 90%. So I don't put anything beyond their reach of trying to save their own asses. Their system is going to blow up, and they know it, I think, or if they're smart, they know it. So I suspect there will be moves they will take. Now, the beautiful thing about both Bitcoin and gold and silver is that they're bearer assets that, you know, they can ask me how much I have, but I have boating accidents all the time, and I keep losing shit, you know. And I think, you know, there'll be a race, which is, you know, how can they figure out who's got what and how to get control of it and how to mess us up versus how quickly is their system disintegrating. And as their system completely disintegrates, you know, the new system, whoever runs the new system, isn't going to care how many Bitcoin I have or how many, you know, ounces of gold I have, because they're likely to be somebody who's in the same boat. You know, the people who are going to be saved by this whole thing are the people who have sound money. I mean, when the dollar becomes worthless, and I sincerely believe that within my lifetime, I'm 66, that within my lifetime, the dollar will become worthless. The dollar will fail. I sincerely believe that. I think it's probably likely to happen between 2028 and 2032, which is kind of the end of this fourth turning as projected by Neil Howe. I mean, he says if he adds everything up, he said maybe worst case, longest ever fourth turning, it could be 2038. But that's still within my lifetime. So I think the dollar is going to fail because I think it has to because of the math. I mean, the only way it doesn't, the only way they're able to extend it, Stefan, is if they preempt that failure by getting really smart and tough. And I'm not sure without a crisis they could do it, but what do I mean by smart and tough? They means test Social Security and Medicare. They shut down half of our bases all around the world. They cut the military budget in half. They go heavily into nuclear to reduce our electrical power costs. They basically balance the federal budget, which to me, the odds of all of these things happening are quite small, absent a crisis forcing them to do it. But it's possible. I mean, it's not outside the realm of possibility. And if they do those things, then I think the dollar won't fail. But again, I look at our political constellation. I don't think the odds of those things happening are very high, at least not based on what I see today.
I see. Yeah. So essentially, it would take massive, massive spending cuts, and that is going to be politically infeasible.
And also think about what those spending cuts would do to the economy. I mean, massive spend. I mean, it would. I mean, any way you look at it, I mean, sadly, it really is sadly because the whole world is going to suffer. But sadly, there's nothing but pain ahead here for a while until we get through this thing. The bright side of that, sadly, is that on the other side of it, a lot of this nonsense that we see in the society and world today is going to just fall away. And everybody's going to go back to kind of, core values and, grifters and bullshit artists and politicians and a lot of the people who've done extraordinarily well under a crazy fiat system, they're going to be wiped out and poor. And the people who've, been careful and husbanded their money in the form of sound money, they're going to be, relatively speaking, better off and able to, I think, return the country, at least the country I want to live in, the United States, to more of its founding principles. Maybe we'll have term limits, maybe we'll have a second constitutional convention. I mean, I don't know what'll happen, but things, a massive change will need to take place. And I think, the only way, sadly, I think the only way to get to that massive change is everything is so effed up that everything's on the table, And so that's how I see it unfolding,
Yeah, it's a sad, but, I think there is optimism on the other side of that.
Oh,
and
definitely.
So we've been talking a little bit about at a government level, government policies and things like that. But I think maybe there's also an element at a social and a cultural level that maybe that will also be part of the shifts too. Like, so as an example, instead of this idea that everybody has to move out at 18, maybe it's more like, no, you actually live with your parents for a bit longer. And instead
Absolutely.
Of paying for multiple homes and apartments or whatever, there's a focus on that, and maybe that is part of the social response to
Absolutely. And also, I think some of the individualism I think will fall away. There'll be much more. I mean, in the millennial generation, I have three millennial kids, and I see them as being much more concerned about the overall well-being of the world and the economy and their fellow beings than my generation of boomers, who were all just about let's see how much we can get. And let's see how fast we can get it. I mean, really, to be quite frank, I mean, in the Reagan 80s, that was what it was all about. And that'll be because, so much pain will have been doled out that it'll be like, hey, can't we figure out a way here to make the world a better place for everybody, not just for the 1%. So I really sincerely believe that could happen and will happen, is likely to happen. The hero generation of the millennials, I think, is going to usher in a much more egalitarian world with a better set of values. And that's my belief.
Yeah, that's interesting, because we are also seeing, along with that cost of living crisis, I'm also seeing a little bit of a generational war. And you might be seeing this also, where there's a bit of boomer hate or boomer.
Absolutely.
People are sort of saying, look at these boomers, look how easy they had it. They could have just bought stocks and bonds and gone to the beach for 40 years, and now they wake up and now they're rich. And now there are young people who are in their 20s and 30s who can't buy a home, who can't get, paid enough to raise a family. This kind of concern. So I'm curious, any reactions you have on some of the generational conflict?
I mean, no doubt. I mean, there are a lot of greedy boomers who have done extraordinarily well. I mean, you know, look, it wasn't as easy as it looked. I mean, there were lots of ups and downs. A lot of people who've done well, you know, worked very hard for what they've got. But yes, they are hanging on to it. And, you know, there's a lot of wealth concentrated in the boomer cohort. And, you know, as a practical matter, what's happening is a lot of boomers are helping their kids out because they have to. I mean, the average, you know, 20-year-old today, how they are going to, on a 20-year-old salary, how are they ever going to be able to afford a house? I mean, they can't. I mean, it's just, the economics are just so tipped upside down. And so this will get resolved. And I, you know, I completely understand the boomer hate. I mean, you know, particularly when you look at like the U.S. Congress and all these elderly people who are in there and, you know, they're just, you know, they're so backward looking. You know, and I mean, back to the student loan thing for just a moment. I mean, you know, in general, I believe that when a debt is taken, it should be repaid. However, having said that, you know, there's something to be said. I mean, in the GFC, we loan money to the banks for free, basically, ZERP. You know, and yet, you know, I think we charge 6% on student loans. I mean, what's that all about? Why do the banks get a 0% interest rate and the students have to pay 6%? You know, I mean, there's a certain amount of, you know, unbalance, as I think you've alluded to, between, you know, between the generations. And the boomers are going to have their benefits cut severely. And they will. And my sense is they'll be able to live with it because, you know, they've had a good run. And, you know, I mean, the one thing that also could get solved throughout all this is just the whole healthcare piece of it. I mean, healthcare in the United States is just such a disaster. I mean, it's not really healthcare, it's sick care. And so, you know, that's another big bugaboo of mine that, you know, everybody's got to start eating well and exercising. And because, you know, that's a long time preference activity, right? So, you know, but yes, there will be generational strife and probably there should be. And, you know, it's time for a lot of these boomers to go. And it's time for reform. And, you know, all I would say, because I am a boomer right in the heart of it, probably almost in the peak year, I was born in 57, is, you know, don't put us all in the same bucket. You know, there are boomers who get it and then there are boomers who don't. And, you know, some of us like myself are, you know, that's kind of what I've dedicated myself to, is trying to fix this system because it, you know, it's a broken system. It's an unfair system. And I care about what my kids and my grandkids are going to, you know, be living in. And, you know, I figure at this stage of my life, the appropriate thing to do is to try and work towards a better system.
Yeah, I mean, that's very admirable. And certainly I see there are some boomers out there who get it, like yourself and people like, you know, Gary Leland and others out there.
Foss,
of course. And so it's interesting that we're seeing some of these demographic battles in a way, because as an example, in Australia, there's fighting going on about the superannuation system, because basically it's kind of similar to the 401k system for Americans. But the gist of it is that they had a preferential tax arrangement. And now what's happening is they're sort of saying, well, actually now we need to tap into that. And so there are all these people who've had kind of like a forced savings in a way, but it's put in this pool that they can't access until they're 65 or 70, or until the technical term is preservation age. And so then it sort of creates this new football that it's a government, you know, controlled, or it can become a government controlled pot of funds.
Oh yeah. That's certainly, when you mentioned earlier, you asked, you know, what are the things the government could do? I mean, one thing they could easily do is say, look, your 401k, you know, you're going to lose your tax benefits in your 401k if you don't use half of it to buy government bonds. I mean, I've kind of been expecting that as a possible, you know, they're certainly, I mean, they can do anything they want, and they've got a problem, which is they're deeply, deeply indebted and getting more and more in debt. And the math suggests that that's going to come to a conclusion here at some point.
Yeah, so it's more just a question of timing then, and you know, how long can they kick the can? Is it going to be one or a few years, or is it really going to be more like, you know, a decade or 2 decades or 3 decades?
I don't think it's 2 or 3 decades. I could see a decade, and I'm just looking at the slope of the curve, and things are happening more quickly, and they're happening at larger scale. I think Howe is pretty good in his generational cycles. I think he's got this one right. If you assume this fourth turning kicked off in 08, and these things typically last 20 years, you know, it feels to me like at the end of this decade, you know, this system will be going through substantial change, and which will be painful, but ultimately very positive for the human race. We'll enter a new season with a better currency system, and you know, all this debt will have been resolved. And frankly, a lot of it will have been written off, you know, so.
Yeah, and that's going to be challenging for some people too, because for them, that other person's debt is their asset, right? They may be bondholders. And so they're going to have to take a loss, and that's going to be rough for them because they're going to feel like, oh, I made all this money after investing and now it's getting written off. And, you know, absolutely. You can see that.
Absolutely. No, look, there's, you know, there are winners and losers here in this whole thing, sadly. And the losers, I mean, the biggest loser without any doubt is going to be anybody who holds any sovereign debt, because these sovereigns have proven themselves to be irresponsible. And this crisis is unfolding at the sovereign level, and that's why it's called the everything bubble. It's unfolding at the level of the money itself. And so, you know, the odds are high, in my opinion, that the money becomes worthless. I mean, you know, people think it can't happen because the U.S. has all the military and we're the reserve currency, we're the largest country, et cetera, et cetera. But if you look at what's going on here, the pattern that we have, you know, basically this has happened over and over again in third world and emerging countries. You know, and Reinhardt and Regoff and their studies and all have shown that, you know, out of 100 examples of countries that have gotten this much debt to GDP, you know, I mean, like 99% of them, you know, either default or massively inflate, you know, to get out of it. And so even though we are the world's reserve currency, I don't think that lets us out of the mathematical problem. I think it's, you know, it's there and it's going to exist.
Yeah. And so that's the other big talk of town, is this de-dollarization narrative.
Yeah.
And are we moving into a multipolar world? Now, I think there's a few things on this, like our friend Safedean, his idea, his view is more like, look, a lot of countries want to try and set up their own alternative. Maybe BRICS is going to try. But at the end of the day, they still need to have a credible enough bond market for other investors to want to buy that thing. And, you know, it's kind of like the Ronnie Coleman quote, everybody wants to be a bodybuilder, but ain't nobody wants to lift this heavy ass weight. And it's kind of like that, but with government bonds. And so even though the US is the worst, or not the worst, it's bad, the US dollar is kind of, you know, devaluing, it's still less bad than the alternatives. So I'm curious how you're seeing that when you kind of blend all of that together, this idea of a multipolar world.
Yeah, well, look, I don't think the dollar is going away. And I'm actually friends with Brent Johnson, and I subscribe to his milkshake theory that, you know, the dollar is the best of all the shitty currencies. They're all fiat currencies, they're all shitty. But, you know, for historical reasons, the dollar is the leading one. But what I think is happening that's very important is that, you know, the dollar used to be, you know, 95% of all trade, you know, was denominated in dollars. And that's changing. That's literally and logistically changing. And you're starting to see countries invoice each other in their own currencies and just trade directly, skipping the dollar. And then the other issue here is you really are talking about two different things. You're talking about what currency do you trade in, so that you need to buy it briefly in order to buy something else. And then you're talking about what currency do you want to store your value in. And I think what's going on is that more and more people, more and more countries are coming to realize that the dollar is not a reliable place to store value. And so, you know, the BRICS in particular have said, we're tired, you know, we're going to make the rules now. We've got all the commodities, you don't. You need our commodities. You've underinvested in commodities for 20 years. We're going to change the rules. You know, and we're going to make you either pay in terms of, you know, using our new BRICS currency, which I think they're going to probably announce in a few days on August 22nd in South Africa, or, you know, we're going to go to something that's more, you know, and I believe what it'll be is it'll be gold backed or gold linked. And so, you know, what they're saying in my opinion is, you know, we know your fiat is losing 7 to 8% every year compound over time, and we're not going to hold it. And so, you know, it's just one more Jenga block being taken out of the debt structure of the United States. I mean, you know, as Luke Groman points out, since 2014, foreign central banks have been net sellers of U.S. treasuries. I mean, we used to be able to run these deficits and, you know, we had buyers all over the world for our debt as a result of the creditworthiness of the United States. That's no longer true. China is now a net seller of U.S. treasuries. And yet all these central banks are also net buyers of gold. Sadly, they're not net buyers of Bitcoin yet. They haven't moved to that step. They're on their way to getting there, but they just don't understand it yet. You know, except El Salvador. And so, you know, they recognize that they need to denominate value in something that governments can't print, because they're very much aware of the issue as well. I mean, it's one of these issues that's just becoming more and more clear to everybody. And like so many things in life, I mean, you know, the first people through the door are going to do the best, right? I mean, the people who bought Bitcoin at $2 or $20 or $100 or even $3,000, you know, are going to do better than the people who are buying it at $300,000, which, you know, there will be plenty of buyers at that level. And so, you know, it's like when you're in a crowded theater and the fire breaks out, first people get out, they're the best escapees. You don't want to be at the end of the line, you know, as the smoke kind of, you know, billows up. And so, you know, it's becoming more and more clear that these currencies do not store value, period. And so, you know, and it doesn't matter which one you're in. And it's interesting to me what's going on in Japan, you know, that, I mean, Japan could actually be one of the first ones to fail. I mean, you see the yen now starting to really slide. And then you've got the Japanese Monetary Authority, you know, basically letting their band of what they're willing to accept as a yield on their 10-year go up in order to try and prevent that slide. And of course, the yen has been, somebody on Twitter had it out, they said, the yen is the ATM at the World Financial Casino. It's the ATM in the lobby because people borrow in yen because it's so cheap in order to speculate in everything else. And so if the yen starts to fail and the yen interest rates start to go up, you know, there's another source of liquidity drying up. So, you know, things are breaking. I mean, you can just, you have to kind of look between the cracks, but things are breaking slowly but surely. And, you know, eventually they're going to cumulatively break enough that I believe we're going to have something that looks again like the 2008 crisis that, you know, and, you know, the signs, I mean, people say, what do you look for? Well, there are really three prices I check when I get up in the morning. Okay. I check the 10-year yield on the U.S. 10-year yield. I check the price of gold and I check the price of Bitcoin. And, you know, I find it very interesting here that in spite of, you know, the toughest monetary tightening campaign since 06 or 05 or 06, or even since, you know, back in Greenspan's days or Volcker's days, well, almost as tough as Volcker's days, you know, I mean, real interest rates having fallen by 500, 600 basis points, that gold is within 5% of its all-time high. And Bitcoin is up 75% this year to date. And so what's going on here is these two sound money assets smell what's coming. You know, they're not buying it. They're not, you know, I mean, in the past, if you'd had this kind of an interest rate raising campaign, gold would have gotten slaughtered. It just would have gotten completely hammered. And some of that Bitcoin rise is coming out of the FTX bounce or the FTX low. I mean, we all know 15,000 occurred because FTX blew up. But the point is that the markets are saying, we see we're looking around the corner and we know what's coming. We know that is, you know, Jay Powell can say whatever he wants, but we know what he's going to be forced to do. And his words are just words. I mean, that's the thing I encourage everybody to understand. I mean, remember when he was saying inflation is transitory and we're not even thinking about raising rates? I mean, that wasn't that long ago. It was 2021, fall of 2021. I mean, the dot plot had, you know, interest rates going to, I don't know, 75 bips or something, maybe 100 bips, you know, up from 30 bips, right? You know, and here we are at 550. I mean, you know, these guys will do whatever is expedient for them at the time. And then they will claim that they, quote unquote, had to do it, you know, that they stopped the ATMs from not working. I mean, you know, that was the claim in 2008 when, you know, Paulson was on his knees begging to Nancy Pelosi, you know, if you don't give us this TARP bailout, you know, the ATMs are going to stop working and the entire country is going to shut down. And of course, she fell for it. And they fell for it and they gave him the money. So, you know, that another moment like that is coming. We just don't know exactly when, but we do know that it's coming. And we do know that the policy response, in my opinion, there are those people who think they'll let us go into a Great Depression. I don't think so. I think they will respond the way Arthur Burns did. And they will turn around and they will, you know, drop rates and start printing again. They have to. So.
Yeah, well said. And so when it comes to this question of, you know, we've seen the yield curve invert, which is also a classic indicator for recessions coming, but there's normally a time lag to these things also that, you know, people are talking about how the housing markets around the world are dropping or in parts of the world. And that cycle can take a few years, right? We might be only 1 year into that, and maybe it takes 2 or 3 years for the property down cycle to happen. And then at that point, that's when the so-called policy response comes.
And actually talking about this, and I'll put it up on my Twitter feed when it comes out. I just got it in my email. But there's a gentleman who was a friend of mine named Dan Oliver, who is really a great monetary historian, is writing a book on the history of money, and has done just really in-depth research. And he goes back into the 1800s. He looks at these, and it tends to be the lag effect, if you kind of average it out, tends to be about 2 years from the time at which the tightening begins. It really bites hard in about the 2 year time window. And so, you know, Powell started raising rates in February of 2022. So 2 years would be February of 2024. And my opinion is it might happen this fall. I mean, to me, Silicon Valley Bank felt like Bear Stearns failing. I mean, Bear Stearns failed in March of 2008, and the GFC hit in September, October. Bear Stearns, I thought, oh, this is big. This is, I mean, I'm sorry, Silicon Valley Bank, this is big. And, you know, 6 month lag. So we could see fireworks this fall, but maybe not. Maybe we make it into next year. Maybe we make it into late next year. I don't think we make it 2 years. I think that this fall next year, you know, things are going to start to happen at an accelerated pace. Now, they'll counter them and that may drag it out longer. So we have to be prepared for that. But at the end of the day, what I rest on is the mathematics of the situation. And so as a result of that, you know, I'm a very long-term investor. My time preference is extremely long. The money I'm investing, I don't need it. In fact, it's probably for my kids or my grandkids. And so as a result, and my goal is to maximize it. So as a result, you know, I'm just very comfortable to sit here and watch the circus come to town, because the circus is coming. we know that, and it could be a hell of a show, right? We know that. And I find it kind of, you know, amusing to watch what the Fed heads say and do and this, that, and the other. And there's certain signposts. Like, to me, you know, as I said, there was an article recently, you know, the genius of Jay Powell. I thought, oh boy, that's a signpost. You know what I mean? All right, Jay, we've reached peak Jay Powell right now. I mean, it's, you know, that's like the Business Week cover that said in 1979, it said the death of equities. And, you know, that was right before we started the 1980s, the largest, you know, run in the bull market in equities we've had in a long, long, long time. And so, you know, to me, this is a very good negative indicator that the genius of Jay Powell is about to start fading very, very quickly, in my opinion.
And you know what? And I'm sure you've seen this as well historically. That's part of the cycle. We've seen Alan Greenspan lauded as this amazing figure. We've seen Ben Bernanke given awards and, you know, lauded as a hero. You know, he wrote his book called The Courage to Act. That's Ben Bernanke's, you know,
right,
book title.
He got a Nobel Prize, right? For ruining the financial system, he gets a Nobel Prize, right? How do you do that?
Yeah, so I guess it comes down to a cultural, like, that's where the culture is, and that's where, let's say, the financial press and the talking heads, the typical talking heads, are just talking in that way, where they're very much praising the central bank, praising the government for being such great stewards and managers, whereas obviously those of us who are skeptical are looking at that as, hey, that's a warning sign, and we are, let's say, playing a waiting game.
Yeah, there's a lot of irony in those kinds of things. As my father always used to say, you know, God has a sense of humor, right? I mean, it's just before he's about to get the shit kicked out of him, they're telling Powell what a genius he is. And we'll see. Let's see how that looks in about a year or two. I think it's going to look substantially different. Yeah.
Well, there you go. All right. Well, I think that's probably a good spot to finish up. I think, you know, we've covered a lot of things, but fundamentally, I think it's fair to say things are breaking.
things are breaking. They're taking a little longer than I thought, but they are breaking. And, you know, I think the good news is we have these great exit paths, and and I think our job, and I know you do it, and I know Swan does it, and I know, you know, everybody I know does it, and that's what I do on Twitter. Our job is just to spread the word as much as possible, because you won't get a do-over on this. I mean, if it happens the way I think it happens, you know, Bitcoin will be through. You know, I mean, the chance to buy Bitcoin below $30,000, I mean, what a gift this is. I mean, what a just an amazing gift. I mean, you know, the fact that you could be a whole coiner still. I mean, that an average person, you know, obviously $30,000 is a lot of money, but that real people, real normal people could, you know, buy one whole coin. And that's an amazing gift, because I don't think that'll happen. You know, that's not likely to happen again, you know, after this next run. And, you know, I think on the next run, gold will take off, go through 3,000. I think Bitcoin will be through 100,000. And, you know, the inflation will be, you know, we'll be back in it, and it'll be, you know, game on. And as we all know, it's suddenly and then all at once, right? I mean, on another podcast, I give an example of how quickly a stadium fills up with water. I mean, exponential functions are hard for people to understand, but when confidence is fully lost, I mean, there's no limit to how far these things can go in terms of their value as measured in dollars, because there's really no floor to what the dollar can be worth, because ultimately the dollar, you know, if total confidence is lost in the United States government, the dollar will be worthless. And I know that's hard for most people to fathom, but I don't think it's entirely outside the realm of possible outcomes. In fact, I think it's one of the more likely outcomes. So, but that's just me, and I've been wrong a lot. So,
well, no, I think that's right. I think it's more just about having the right time preference and the time period on that, right? Because I'm sure people are going to say, "Oh, the dollar's worth is well, not tomorrow. It's not going to happen tomorrow."
Let's talk 10-year window. 10-year window, yeah. I'm pretty comfortable with the projection. Like I say, I could still be very wrong. We'll see. But I think people who save in Bitcoin terms or silver and gold terms are going to appreciate the fact that they've done that versus some of the other choices they have for where to put their money.
Fantastic. Well, that's a great spot to finish. Larry, where can people find you online?
Yeah, so I have a website, ema2.com. You know, the videos are up there. Our quarterly letters are up there. There's a free sign up for the quarterly letters. We won't spam you. And then I make a lot of noise on Twitter, just at my name, at Lawrence Lepard. And most of it's just anti-central bank, anti-fiat money.
That's what we love to see. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you, Larry, and hope to see you soon.
Yeah, we enjoyed it. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed the show. If you did, please make sure to leave a like and share the show with your family and friends. Get the show notes at StefanLevera.com. Thank you, and I'll see you in the Citadels.